So yes, welcome everybody to the North London Buddhist Centre monthly women's class. We have a guest each month, and this month I'm completely delighted to welcome Parami. Parami is a really good friend of mine, and also my preceptor, as in she is the woman who witnessed my readiness for ordination and ordained me.
Came up with a good name.
Came up with a really, really good name. Best name.
Best.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Karanagita. Karanagita. Karana, compassion. And Gita, song, noble song. So she who sings the song of compassion.
It's good, isn't it?
It's good, isn't it? Yeah. A reminder to speak out about things I care about in the world, which it's really been, actually. I've changed a lot in that respect in the last 12 years. So what we're going to do today is that I'm going to interview Parami. This is totally unscripted and could go any which way, but Parami has been really centrally involved in Tri Ratna in many different ways, as you will learn, for 40 years now.
I was very, very young. Like 12. Sorry, that's the first lie, isn't it? Set it up well.
And we haven't practiced this. We had about 3 minutes over breakfast this morning. And I was saying, let's do it this way. Yeah, it's fine. So we'll see how it goes. But I'm really, really grateful to Parami for being here. Not least because... Well, what we thought we'd do is start actually now and go backwards rather than start in the 70s and come forwards. Partly because Parami flew in from Mexico last night and got to my house at about 7 o'clock in the evening. And you were speaking at a Buddha Day Wesak festival in Mexico last weekend, weren't you?
Yeah, last Sunday.
Yeah, so maybe you could just start by saying a bit about what you've been doing in Mexico.
So I was in Mexico for about 5 weeks this time, which is the longest trip that I've done for a while. I used to go for about 6 weeks every year, but because I've been really busy for the last some years, I've been going for less shorter visits, but this time we had a really special occasion, which was we had a GFR retreat, a women's retreat, a retreat for women in training for ordination, on which we had 7 ordinations. So that was pretty historic. It was great, actually. It was really, I'm going to talk for ages, so I don't anyway, we might never get to the 70s.
We can do the 70s more briefly, if you like, yes.
So it was really, it was fantastic having 7 women entering the order, 7 Mexican women. It's the biggest series of ordinations we've had in Mexico, men or women. And, some of them are quite young. They were ranging in age from 26 or something like that, 27, I think, the youngest, up to 50 was the oldest, recently turned 50. So that was really nice, sort of bunch. And there were 48 of us on the actual retreat, so that was really quite something as well. They've got a really nice retreat centre in Mexico called Chintamani, which is kind of, it was beyond capacity really, but it was great. And in the middle of it, we had the private ordination. So we had one day where we were in silence. We'd been in silence for about 3 days. And on that particular day, we just sat in the shrine room for the whole day. We had a session from 7 in the morning till 7 in the evening. And each hour, virtually, somebody went off to be ordained. So, and we did it old style, because these days it doesn't quite happen like that, at least in the big retreats. But so we were all in there as each woman left, you know. So we're kind of sitting there wishing her well as she went off to be ordained, and then watching them coming back in and sort of just seeing them, the glow that kind of came back in them. And the other thing that was really great that I'd like to mention about that retreat was that some of you know this because you are my friends on Facebook, but I'd done some fundraising for some women from Venezuela. So we managed to raise enough money for 6 women to come from Venezuela for the retreat. which is pretty momentous, really. They've got a centre, well, it's more of a group than a centre at the moment, really. And some of these women have been practising for a long time, but they've never been outside Venezuela. A couple of them have, but for all of them, I think it was the first. It was the first time they'd ever been in a JFR retreat, a retreat with other women training for ordination. It was the first time they'd met any Dharmacharinis other than myself and Jnana Dakini from Mexico. And some of them have met Kema Jyoti way back, like 18 years ago or something. So that was just, and it was just fantastic, sort of having these women in the group. So partly they were so appreciative that it really had quite a big effect on the whole retreat. So that was great. So that was the beginning of the trip. And then we had the public ordination ceremony in the Mexican Buddhist Centre, live streamed, which was pretty historic as well.
I watched it.
It's been watched by over 8,000 people.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it's been downloaded and at least looked a bit at by over 8,000 people. I doubt all of them watched all 2 hours of
it. I watched all 2 hours, yeah.
Yeah, no,
it was happened. It was fabulous, yeah.
Yeah, it was great to be able to do that, really. And then I've just been doing other things, meetings, individual meetings, meeting with the council of the Buddhist Centre, meeting with the women's GFR team, etc., etc.
And that, just to sort of clarify, is part of your role, because you're what's termed international order convener,
well,
isn't it?
It's hard to know, really. I mean, yes, I'm international. That's not hard to know. I know I'm the international order convener. It's hard to know what that means, but I know I'm it. But I'm also public preceptor. And actually, there are now 16 women order members in Mexico. And this was the first time that when women, of those 7 who were ordained, I was neither private nor public preceptor to. I'm either private or public preceptor to all the others. So it's hard to know. Like, next year I'm going to stop being order convener. Sorry, it's been a great job. But it's been a long time. I'm going to carry on doing the sort of things that I do. I'm not going to stop going to Mexico. So, yeah, I go wear a number of hats on, as they say.
And with the international order convening role, is that when you move to Adistana? Because you currently live at Adistana, don't you?
I do currently live at Adistana. I actually moved to Birmingham when I became order convener, and then part of my first task was to look for a property. So I was one of the people that looked for properties for 3 years and then found Adistana.
So I don't know if it's worth saying something about Adistana for people who don't know about that. So Parami currently lives at Adistana, which is...
So Adistana's it's a place that we bought 4 years ago nearly, 3.5 years ago. And it's an old school. It was a school for kids on the autistic spectrum originally. So when we first moved there, some of them I think were quite severely autistic. So when we first went there, there were padded rooms, which was a bit strange, but actually I think it's got a really nice vibe. So we decided in 2009, I think, that Sangha actually agreed to move, basically. So he lives there. He'd been living in Birmingham, and we'd been trying to persuade him for a while that it would be a really good idea to move somewhere in the country that could be used as a retreat centre and a meeting place for order events particularly. And he wasn't very keen on moving. Partly, I think old people don't like moving. Just sort of, generally speaking, I think it's quite disconcerting. Also, his site's pretty well gone. So I think that, for that reason as well, the idea of going to somewhere completely new didn't really appeal. And then he realised, he said actually to me, chatting to me at one point, that he realised it was a sort of going forth, that although he would prefer to stay where he was, actually, for the movement, it would be a good move to have somewhere else. So when he said that, we started looking, and we found this place after 3 years, I think, of searching. We saw some fabulous places on the Scottish borders. But many people said it was too far away. I mean, too far away from what exactly was never quite discussed, because nothing's too far away from nowhere, if you see what I mean. There's always a point of reference, which in this case did seem to be London, that has to be said. Given that the Brits, I have to say, the English do tend to think anywhere other than north of Watford Junction, something's a long way away. Sorry, apologies to those of you from London. But anyway, we ended up with this place, which was really the best possible place. It was good by And so we use it. So Sangha actually lives there. We're a small community of people that look after him. There's a men's community and a women's community. There's 10 of us in the women's community. 9 today, one of the women's moving out. And 13 in the men's community. So, and we do have quite a strong sense of being all together as a community as well. So though we get separate houses, we have community nights together and we meditate together every morning. So, yeah, it's used for all sorts of things. I mean, a lot of you have been there. I think all the older members probably have been there, and quite a few others, I think, have been there. And it's great, actually. We can use it for multiple things happening at the same time. So that really works quite well. Like, sometimes we've had an order weekend and a small meeting or something and a little retreat for something else. And people, quite a few order preceptors have been booking it to use for reunion retreats for the people they've ordained. So it can be used for lots of different purposes. And as I say, Sangharakshita actually lives there. So we get a lot of visitors coming who went to meet with him when he's well enough and come and stay. We get a lot of visitors from overseas. We get Kiwis and Aussies and Americans and Indians, and it's really nice, actually. It does feel quite like living in a hub or something. And I love the courtyard. For those of you who have been there, there's a sort of central courtyard, which in the summer we've usually got seats and tables and things out. That's really nice. And it's a little bit, somebody was saying we should have a live webcam on that, because you just see all these meetings and greetings happening. She's really nice. Sometimes people that haven't seen each other for years bump into each other in the courtyard at Adistana, so that's nice. Yeah.
I think it works really, really well. I think it's an excellent choice of place. It's a very, it's attractive, but not really sort of grand and ostentatious. Mm. It's got a lovely lake and grounds and beautiful walks on the Morven Hills.
And swales.
Oh, yes, it's got the swales.
The swales are the sewage system, which we're very, very proud of. We spent a lot of money on them. It's a whole ecosystem. Mm. Wow. So you've got, there's 3 ponds that go down. So the first pond is where the sewage comes in, and it's got a whole ecosystem that purifies it, a biosystem. Mm-hmm. So by the time it gets to the bottom, when you can actually swim, so I'm told.
Yes.
I haven't actually done it myself, but I know a number
you
of people there.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people have, actually. Yeah. It's not because of it being part of the sewage system. It's just that it's cold. You'd never get me in there.
Yeah. It was cold.
Yeah, it was. But quite a lot of people have been in there and swum, so it's quite nice, actually.
But it is, yeah. It is a lovely feeling, isn't it, there, that you do get lots of groups and people meditate together and eat together, even if they're doing different things. It's really...
Yeah, so we can have up to about... I think for bed space, we've got about 120. Mm. But we have had events with 400... on them, camping events for 400, which we need to be a bit careful of, because the neighbours aren't that pleased with having quite so many people quite so often, so which, we don't do it that often, but this year there's a big mixed order weekend in August, and then the weekend after that there's the what they for some reason call the International Retreat, which is not an international. It's a European retreat, really. But anyway, which I don't know if any of you are planning to go. And it's a family-friendly camping. We used to do them at Tararuaka.
Is it a weekend?
It's a long weekend, yeah. Long weekend. So actually, I'll be on that for the first time in years. Because they've been doing them in May, June, which usually coincides with the ordination period at Akashavana. So I'm quite pleased. I really like them. Mm. And I have a bed, so I don't have to camp, so that's good.
So tracking back in time, you've just come back from Mexico. The last 3 years you've been living at Adistana, so very much as a hub of things. And before that you were living for a while in Birmingham, weren't you?
I was, as
a hub of things.
I was. Yeah. So I didn't really want to live in Birmingham. It's never been the city that's appealed to me greatly. I don't know if any of you are Birmingham people, but it's never been a city that I thought, oh, I'd love to live in Birmingham, you know. But so, in fact, I was living in Tararuaka. Before that, and I took on this job as order convener. And it was Banty actually that said to me, oh, well, but you'll be moving to Birmingham then. And I said, oh, I don't think so. Doubt it. Anyway, 3 times he said it to me. And the 3rd time I said, okay, just tell me, why would I want to live in Birmingham? He said, well, I live there. I thought, well, I can't really argue with that. I couldn't really sort of argue back with that one, so I moved to Birmingham. Which was fine, actually. I lived for a while. Oh, actually, it was quite slightly spooky, let me tell you this, because it is slightly spooky. Woo-woo. So I was visiting. I've got friends who live in Birmingham, Samachitta and Punyavadri, who some of you know. So I used to go to Birmingham a lot for meetings, because we had a lot of meetings in Majumaloka. I'm smiling at Rupavati, because she had many years living there. Anyway, so I used to go to meetings and I'd stay with them. And they live in this house, which is just through the back. The back garden connects with the Buddhist centre. So we were sitting in the back garden, and now it's summery sort of afternoon. And they were saying, oh, come on, move to Birmingham, move to Birmingham. So I said, all right, I'll move to Birmingham if that flat there becomes empty. And the flat above them. And they were like, yeah, it's not going to happen. The guy who lives there, he really likes it, blah, blah, blah. I was like, well, I'm sorry, I'm not moving them. And about 3 days later, Sam had checked for me and said, you're never going to believe this. Mike's just giving in his notice and he's going to move in with his partner or something like that. It's like, okay. So I moved to Birmingham. And actually, it was quite good living. It was a great place to live in terms of the Buddhist centre and stuff. It's very lively. Mm-hmm. And I've got quite a few friends who live there. And Banty was around the corner, so I was seeing quite a lot of him. Mm-hmm. And also it meant that I was working with a guy called Mahamati. He was the other order convener. There's two of us. I'm not the women's order convener, and he wasn't the men's order convener. We're joint overall international order conveners, if that makes sense. So I work with the men and women when I travel, and likewise. Anyway, he's not the order convener anymore, but he was living there, and Damarati, who was at that time chair of the college, was living there. So the three of us could just hang out together, and well, we worked together, but it was easier because we were just living close together, so we could go for a coffee or a meal and just sort of talk a bit about things. And actually, out of that, we created this structure, partly out of those meetings, which is called the International Council meeting, which is quite an important structural part of Sri Ratna. Mm-hmm. So that kind of grew out of that period of living in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And try to think, how could we bring together people from around the world within the Sri Ratna community, from the different bits of it? Mm-hmm. So,
do you want to say something about, in a way, what sort of encouraged or inspired or persuaded you to take on that role? Because it's quite a big role, isn't it, in terms of coordinating and overseeing and
well,
things.
It's become bigger. So it's 9 years ago that I took it on. It'll be 10 years next year, which is why I'm going to finish next year. Mm. I think 10 years is enough.
So 2008 you started, yeah.
Yeah, 2008. Mm. So, actually, Mahamati approached me and asked me if I was interested in being put forward to take on the job that somebody called Dayanandi had been doing beforehand. So she was women's order convener. So at that point, there was a man who was the overall order convener for the whole order, worldwide. And then there was Dayanandi, who was women's order convener for the UK and Europe. And she was moving on, so he approached me and said, was I interested in that? And I said, no, I wasn't actually. I was quite interested in his job, but I wasn't particularly interested in being the women's order convener. Sorry. You know, I mean, it was one of those things that I always found slightly irritating, that at that point there was only one international order convener. And to his credit, he jumped at it. He was really, really keen that there were two of us working together, and he made a lot of sense. There was a man and a woman. So then there was a whole process of consulting the order about whether, you know, I was an appropriate person to do that. I did get some feedback from some people who thought I wasn't, but anyway, at the end of the day, they all seemed to be happy. So, and actually, why I thought it was interesting, because it was a bit of a, I don't know, the word comes to my mind, sacrifice, but it's not quite the right word. It sounds far too, I'm not that sacrificing a kind of person, but there were other things it meant I had to stop doing, which felt quite like, I was very involved in trying to help set up some kind of socially engaged bit of things in the order and the movement. So this is 10 years ago, and it was a little bit of an uphill struggle, actually, in some ways. And I'd been done some training or some work with Joanna Macy, who some of you will have heard of. And I was quite keen to bring some of her stuff into Sri Ratna. Not just lift it and bring it in, but because I could see ways that Tree Ratna could work with it that could be quite quite exciting and quite creative with some of her exercises and stuff. So I was doing quite a bit of that at that time, around 2004, 2005, 2006, around then. So I knew I was going to have to give something up if I became... I was already a public preceptor, so if I became order convener, it was like, oh gosh, it's just... I can't do all of that. But I think partly I thought... So this was 2008. I thought, it's quite likely that Bante will die in the next few years, which is what we all thought, which is what we've been thinking since the late 90s. And I thought I might be quite a good person to hold some of that over that period, partly because I knew a lot of people and I had a lot of connections around the world. So that was mainly why I thought I'd probably be quite a good person to do it. And because it was the sort of thing I was doing anyway, going out and visiting places and travelling and teaching a lot and doing a lot of retreats and things. So it kind of felt like it was in stream with a bit of what I was doing. But there was a whole other bit of that I was doing that I had to kind of let go of for a while. So,
but it is very much a sort of life in service, isn't it? Because you're just, you know, that's it determines a lot, you know, especially going,
Yeah, and it's actually has been great. I mean, it's a great privilege, you know. I actually get paid not very much, but I get a sort of enough to live on to travel around and visit places, and it's pretty good, really, isn't it?
Thank you. So that's sort of going back, you know, Birmingham was the move, you know, when you became International Order Convener. And before that, you were at Tararoa, which is a women's retreat centre, which a lot of you will have been at. You were living there for how many years? I can't remember.
I can't remember if it was 4 or 5. I can't remember if it was. I think I moved in 2005, which means it was 4 years.
Yeah.
But I'd been going back and forward quite a lot to there before that. And I had a year or so where I didn't really live anywhere when I finished living in Valencia in Spain. And I hadn't yet decided where to live. And so I was going to Tararoa quite a lot in that year. And then they very... It was quite... I was trying to think what to do when I came back from Spain. Trailers.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about where to go. And actually, my heart was into going back to Scotland. I wanted to go to Glasgow, which is where I'm from, in case you hadn't noticed. And so there was a women's community in Glasgow in a house owned by the Buddhist Centre. So the plan was that I'd move there. I would be partially... I could live there rent-free and I would do some work for the Glasgow Buddhist Centre, but that would leave me free to travel. So it was a pretty good deal, really. And then the community collapsed. Not anything to do with me moving in, I'd like to add. But there were just, for all sorts of reasons, the people that were living in that community made decisions that meant they weren't going to live there anymore. And the idea of going back to Glasgow and living in a flat or something, it didn't really appeal to me. And then anyway, they decided to sell the place that they had been using. So circumstances just changed. I spent 2 months in Glasgow in the summer of 2005. Yeah, it would have been 2005. And there was something about the fact that the conditions that I thought were going to be there weren't going to be there. So I thought, oh, maybe it's not quite the right thing. And then I thought about moving back to London where I'd lived previous to Spain. But then that didn't quite feel right either. And then I was at Tararoa for quite a lot that summer. I was leading things and the college meeting was there. The public preceptors were meeting there. And there was something else, can't remember. But I was there for quite a long chunk. And I was walking across the courtyard at some point and I thought, oh, I could live here. Where did that thought come from? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a city girl, born and bred, and I've always lived in cities until fairly recently. And I thought, oh, God, I'd hate it here. But I couldn't quite let go of the idea. And it was feeding into a little fantasy that I've got of being a nun, which my original fantasy was being a Catholic nun when I was young, mainly because I kept falling in love with nuns. But I didn't think that was a good reason. But anyway. But also, I did have a bit of a pull towards a more contemplative life, which is strange for people who know me, but I have got that. And I think something about being in Tararoa over that time, I just thought, actually, I could... This could feed the bit of me that doesn't usually get fed. So I just voiced it to Sadhanandi, what do you think? You know, and she jumped at the chance and was really keen. So then they said, yeah, come and live here. And they were really generous to me. I lived there rent, you know, I just lived there. They supported me to live there and just do precept and work, which was great. And it gave me, it was quite a good, way of coming back from Spain. Because it was such a different lifestyle in many ways, and I think moving straight back into something else would have been a bit... I needed space to sort of work out what to do next, in a way. And it wasn't that I wasn't doing anything. I was pretty busy even in that period of living there. But, yeah, they were really generous to me, the community there. And there were a lot of my friends living in the community at that time. There were a lot of people there that I knew well. So it was a good place to come back into.
We're going to accelerate through time in a moment, but just wanted to touch on something that you did in that period, in 2005. I believe you did your first ordination in English.
I did, which was your good self.
Put that out there, yeah.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
That's right. So I became a public preceptor in 2004. And I did one ordination in 2004, which was... doesn't really matter. That was in Mexico. And then I did some public ordinations in 2004 in Tiratnaloka. And then 2005, we had this Tiratnaloka retreat. It was a big retreat.
Yeah, I mean, I was ordained at Tiratnaloka, which is another one of the retreat centres in Wales, all for preparation for ordination. But there were 22 of us from, I think, seven countries.
Something like that.
It was really international. It was fantastic. Lots of different language groups as well, including... some Spanish speakers, well, I can't remember. Anyway, but it was a fantastic...
Oh, yeah, there was Sasachi and Yanada.
Yeah.
No, they were the year before.
They
were a couple of years before, actually.
Yeah. Anyway, so sort of going back through time, so you've already sort of... We've done a bit of...
Trailing,
yeah. So prior to coming back to England and being at Tiratnaloka, you were in Spain for quite a while, weren't you?
13 years.
13 years. You were in Spain when I met you.
Yeah.
Even though I met you in England, yeah.
So I moved to Spain in 92. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And lived in the centre, lived in Valencia and helped run the centre. I was chair of the centre in
Did
Valencia.
You start the centre in Valencia, or was it already going?
It was kind of going. There were a couple of people there, but it wasn't really very... There was a men's community, which Moksha Nanda, who's an order member who lives in Spain, he was living there. And they did classes in the front room. And then Paramachita and I moved there in 92. And one of the first things we did was get the centre out of the men's community because it didn't really work. I mean, it worked fine for a while. They had a bit that was reception and shrine room and stuff. But it was awkward. You know, I think that's happened to a number of places in Tiratna where there's a men's community. It generally seems to be a men's community and a centre in the same building. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And in this case... it stopped working partly because one of the men order members in particular just really didn't like having people coming in and out. So he started putting signs up, like saying, no pasar, and things like that, you know, no entry and things. And it just became unpleasant. So before I became chair, we decided to look for separate premises. So we did that. And then... they're now in their third or fourth premises now. Mm. Big, they've got quite a big centre.
Yeah, I visited that one a few years ago.
Yeah,
it's really nice. And you were working in the shop there, weren't you, in order to earn a living, basically, yeah.
Well, it was partly that, but it wasn't just that. It was because I thought it was really important to have a right livelihood.
Mm.
So we opened an evolution shop, so some of you will know evolution. And... it was run by... the idea at that point was there was a men's team running that and a women's team running the centre. But it didn't really work quite like that. So we all worked everywhere, basically. I mean, it was theoretically going to be single sex, but it never really quite happened. Which I think actually was quite good for all sorts of reasons. So I took on being chair of the centre so that Moksha Nanda would take on running the shop. So we'd work kind of between us, cover everything. But then for all sorts of reasons, he left the shop and it was going to close because there weren't enough people. And Windhorse, who were funding it, they wanted order members working there. They wanted it to be very firmly order-run business. And nobody else wanted to do it. So I thought, I almost swore there, but I went, oh, well, I'll just do it. You know. So I actually was working, it started off 2 days a week and ended up full-time in the shop. Running the Buddhist Centre as well. So it was a pretty full-on period. It was great, though. I loved working in the shop, especially at Christmas.
I think probably your life has been characterised by some fairly full-on periods, yeah. really, and also quite a lot of that stepping in to do yeah. something because actually there wasn't really anyone to yeah. do it. And
Yeah, no, I couldn't bear the thought of the shop closing, you know, because... And actually a number of people who worked in that did go in to get ordained and, you know, it was a really helpful, good context for people. And, it was just a really good way of also being linked in. I think one of the things that's always really motivated me is the sense of as being an international order. And living in Spain, although it's not very far away, it could feel very far away at times, you know. Partly language, because a lot of the Spanish Sangha don't speak English. So I felt as chair one of my jobs in a way, or partly my... What really moved me was to make sure that people felt they were linked into something bigger. And also that people in the UK had a sense of people outside the UK. That was quite important. So the shop was part of that, because it meant that people came over from Windhorse to visit, and we'd send people from Spain over to Windhorse for seminars and meetings and things. So it was really, really important... It also, in the end, gave us the money, because we were in a part of Valencia which became very upmarket. It wasn't when we took the shop, but we were priced out, basically. Mm. We couldn't carry on. But we were given quite a bit of money by the landlord to kind of get us out, which worked actually quite well because, well, there were all sorts of, I think that it was a bit more sophisticated than that. But anyway, we ended up with a little bit of money, which meant we could put it into the centre that we've now got. So it was definitely worth having. I couldn't bear the thought of it closing down just because of the lack of people to work in it.
And did you speak Spanish when you went to Spain, or you had to learn it there, yeah? So that's quite a going forth, isn't it?
Yeah,
just to think, okay, I'm off to Spain, don't speak the language. There's nothing much happening there, not really knowing anyone.
Yeah, well, Paramichit and I going together helped.
Yeah.
You know, the fact there were two of us went made a big difference. But it was, I was ready for something. I was 40. I moved to Spain in the year I turned 40. And I was kind of ready to move on from the LBC. For all sorts of reasons. And it was Mokshananda said to me, why don't you come and live in Spain? And I thought, yeah, all right, I could do that. It's good an idea as any. So I did do some Spanish classes in London before I went. I did classes in the Cervantes Institute in near Victoria, which was full of people. It was almost all women, and they were all wives of diplomats and bankers and people like that were going to move to whatever, Uruguay or somewhere in the diplomatic service. So the kind of vocabulary that was aimed at didn't really quite work for me. So generally people were learning how to say my husband is a diplomat. So I used to quite like stirring the class up by saying things like, yeah, I'm a lesbian and I haven't got a husband because I'm a lesbian and I'm a Buddhist and blah blah blah. And actually I was working in the Terence Higgins Trust at the time, which was which is an HIV charity. And so I used to have a bag full of condoms because I would go to toilets, men's toilets, and hand out condoms as part of, you know, as you do. And I was walking back with some of these women from this class, walking through Victoria Station one night, and these three guys come up and they were like, Parmy, have you got any condoms? yeah, sure I have. What do you want? Hard, you know, heavy duty, like what you flavour. And these women were just like, their eyes were completely popping out of their head. So at the next class, one of them mentioned it, and the teacher sort of said, why'd you carry condoms? And I said, it was for my work, which wasn't quite the right answer. Well, it was literally the right answer, but it gave a rather false impression. But, so I had to learn to say in Spanish, no soy prostituta. Anyway, so that was my Spanish learning. So it was much more useful when I was actually there and I could learn Spanish that was I could use.
Yeah. And then going back from Spain. Before that, you were at the London Buddhist Centre, which several people here go regularly to the London Buddhist Centre as well, which is over in Bethnal Green.
So I was part of the almost founding generation of the LBC, actually.
What year was that when you went? Was started at the LBC?
I moved to London in 1978. And I lived... So the centre hadn't opened then. Mm. So I lived in a women's community called Amaravid, which was in Wanstead, east. And I used to come in on the tube to support classes and things. Mm. So the LBC hadn't opened yet. It was still in the building phase. I can't remember. I think it must have opened in 79.
79, yeah.
It must have opened in 79.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would have done. And so I was in East London and going to classes and supporting. We used to use what became Bodywise, which some of you probably would
Bodywise,
know.
Yeah.
Well, before it was Bodywise, it was called... It was the annex to the LBC, and before it was the annex to the LBC, it was the East End Meditation Centre. Mm. So we used to do classes there while they were doing the building work and the Buddhist Centre, what became the LBC. So I lived in this women's community. There were 13 of us. So I was a Mitra then, and then in probably in 79, maybe at the end of 79, the LBC opened, and at the same time, the women's community that I lived in, we had to give the house up. It was a squat, basically, that we were living in. And the community moved to different places. And I went to West London. Mm. So I was actually a Mitra in West London for a while. That was where I got ordained. Mm. I was living in West London.
So what year did you get ordained?
1980.
So you were a Mitra when you were living in Wanstead, travelling supporting classes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and quite recently. I mean, what would be really nice, you know, is just to get a bit of, especially because this is obviously the women's class, and just to get a flavour of what it was like in those days, sort of, just a quick flavour.
As a
woman, you know, in the sort of early days, because they were quite, you know,
May I refer you to a whole series of talks that were given at the LBC, I don't know, quite a long time ago now. The Shuba, who was the women's Mitra convener, I think, then organised, and I think on Free Buddhist Audio they're called Elders Talks or something. So some of you were probably at some of them, and so I gave a talk at that, and the number of people, Dhammadina, Malika, there were a whole load of people who, I think they actually invited.
I remember that.
They invited every woman who'd been ordained by Sangharakshita to give a talk there about, you know, what it was like being a woman in the early days. So they're really good talks. They're interesting because they're historically, and I believe there's a new project happening, which Dharma Prabha knows about, to try and record some of those.
We have aspiration to create an order project where we start recording women's history, the women's wing story, and that will also involve Mitras to help us to interview. So that's in the making.
Yeah, which is great, actually. I'm really pleased that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I was recently at Hadistana, where Parami now lives, on a retreat as a sort of training to become a preceptor. And that was led by quite a lot of, you know, the elders. I mean, Parami wasn't actually there because she was in Mexico ordaining more women. Yeah. But it's really good to sort of think about what it was like in those days. And I just remember feeling an incredible amount of gratitude to people who... We're just working, you know, actually people, you know, coming in, a bit like you, that you come in, you're around for about a year, and then you're already leading things, already starting things. Mm-hmm. And particularly at some point in that, the men's and women's activities separated out quite a lot.
Yeah.
And because Sangharakshita, who started the movement, is a man, you know, he was teaching men. And so there's quite a lot of women, weren't there, that were teaching really early on and doing a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, he did a lot of mixed things as well, Sangharakshita. So, like, when I was a Mitra and early ordained, he did a lot of women's seminars. It was about, I can't remember how many he did, but over quite a few years. And I was on quite a few of them. And they were great, actually. I mean, well, actually, they were really tedious as well. At times, if you read the transcripts, there's hours of conversations that were pretty tedious. But I guess any seminar's a bit like that. And then moments where you just felt, whoa, you know, that was pretty amazing. So, yeah, I mean, in a way, initially, when I got involved in Glasgow, going back, we had mixed. Everything was mixed, in a way. And then I remember the guys, there were only men order members. And there were only a small handful of women Mitras, actually. It was predominantly men at the centre, but everything was mixed. And then the guys came back from a weekend, I think in Pavmaloka, which they'd just purchased. They were all quite excited about it. And they'd obviously been talking about the need to have more men-only events. So I'm personally a fan of single-sex events. I think for most people, they've been very helpful. I think they're people that they don't quite work for all sorts of reasons. But I think certainly over years, they've been really helpful. But it was not well done, in a way, the sort of separation, at least in some places. So the guys will come back. So I was in a Mitra group, which was all men and me, because I was the only woman Mitra at the time. And they came back and said, oh, we're just going to have men only Mitra study now. And I was like, what? You know, hello? Where does that leave me? So I had a big argument through the keys of the centre, you know, sort of dramatic, stomped off. Damarati ran up the road after me. But in a way, that was a bit of a precursor of how certain things are going to be. And actually, a lot of those guys have apologised since then. And I think what happened was the idea to have more events for only women or only men in itself was a good idea. But I think the way it was put into place, particularly, I think, by some of the men, not all of them, but by some of the men, I think it fed into their own sort of insecurity and even, to some extent, unconscious misogyny. So I think what happened was that for some of the guys, it gave them carte blanche to be obnoxious, you know, and in a way I think there was a whole lot of reasons for that, and part of it was just lack of maturity. You know, I think we were all young, we were all pretty immature. So I was, when I got at that point, I would have been 25 26. I'd come from a strong feminist Marxist background. These guys were all, you know, I was obviously more articulate and intelligent than most of the men that I was dealing with. And they found that hard, you know, I think that was just sort of how it was. You know. So, you know, and I was used to being in Marxist groups, so I don't know if any of you have got that kind of background, but they're abrasive. And I'm Glaswegian. So that's abrasive, you know. So we'd have these sort of Mitra study groups where, you know, somebody would say something which I just thought was frankly stupid. So I would tell them that in a not helpful or creative way. I hadn't learned any NVC. I specialised, at that point, I think I specialised in violent non-communication. So, you know, so I think I obviously brought what I brought to it as well, so I don't actually feel particularly blamey about how that period was. You know, and I've had some interesting conversations with some of the guys from that period. But it was quite tough, and I think actually partly being abrasive, aggressive in Glaswegian was quite helpful, because I never at any point felt, I never believed any of the rhetoric about men being better than women. I just thought it was effing stupid, and why would you think that? But I could see that for a lot of the women that were contemporaries of mine that had different backgrounds, it didn't have, you know, it was unhelpful, and it, you know, basically people's confidence got quite thrown at times, I think. So, yeah, that was quite an interesting period. And actually, I think the women's wing grew in great strength out of it, to be honest. I think in the face of adversity in some ways. And it wasn't all like that. And a lot of the guys weren't like that at all. And in my own personal experience, Sangha Akshita was never anything but extraordinarily supportive and encouraging. I've never found Sangha Akshita in any way personally to be misogynistic at all, ever. Nor Subhuti, who's the other one that gets, you know, tarred with that brush as well a bit. And I can understand why, but my own personal experience, they've always been Kalyana Mitras and very helpful to me. So, but it was okay. It was ridiculous period of times. I mean, for example, I remember when a mixed order event, we were having single sex order weekends by then, which meant there were about 11 of us in the women's order weekends. And I hated that, because before that there'd been about 60, 70, 100 of us in order weekends, which I really liked. And then suddenly there was like, all the guys were in the LBC and we were up the road in the annex. Which was made sense, because there was 60, 70 of them and 10, 12 or something of us. And we were going to come to Siddhi Ratna, who some of you might know, had this idea we should come together and do a puja at the end all together. So I was leading the women's order weekend. The person that was leading the men's order weekend asked me if I'd lead the puja. I was like, yeah, that's fine. And then he came to the door of the community and the evening of the Saturday or whatever, and said, oh, listen, some of the guys have said they won't come if you're leading the pooja because you're a woman. And I was like, why? You know, anyway, so I thought, oh. So then we had an interesting discussion in the women's order weekend where some of them were going, just lead it anyway, if they don't come, they shouldn't come. And actually I thought, I'm not going to do that, you know. I'm not going to fight like that. It's not, I just don't mean to. They're stupid. They can just be stupid. So I didn't lead the puja. But it was just things like that were just, happened quite a bit. But as I say again, so then, or there was a retreat that I was leading, you know, the big LBC does retreats twice a year, big, well.
Yeah, I was on one of them, my first retreat in England, yeah.
Yeah, so I was part of the team that led them from when they started. I did 18 of them. I did two a year for 9 years, the team that had people at Attila and Damarati, and I was, they were brilliant, actually, those retreats. And so I was then to lead one. I think I'd been a day in 2 years or something. And somebody who was chair of our centre in Brighton at the time, was no longer in the order, actually wrote a letter to the LBC Council saying he couldn't possibly promote this retreat because it was a mixed retreat being led by a woman and only men should lead mixed events. So the LBC Council got this letter and they were like, what do we do? So I said, well, so I was seeing Banty for a different reason. So I said, I'll ask Banty what he thinks. And he was so cross about it, actually, and just said, you know, that's ridiculous. You know, of course you're the best person to be leading this retreat. And in fact, he said, I've been thinking about these retreats and I've decided to say who I think should lead them. So he gave a list of 5 people that he was happy with leading those big retreats at the time. And 2 of them, Damodena was one of them, and myself and 3 guys. So, you know, in a way it was interesting that he was never seemed to be behind that particular view that a woman shouldn't lead mixed events. But it was prevalent with some of the men. That was then.
Yeah, that was then. This is now. I mean, and you know, it is interesting when I sort of look back and people in their 20s and just coming into all of it. You know, it's sort of not surprising that people wouldn't necessarily behave with the maturity we would now expect.
And I think I was fortunate in that I always had a personal relationship with Sangha Rakshita right from when I started, from my first week in the centre, actually. So I could go to him and say, so-and-so says this, did you really say that, you know? And he would say, well, they've taken it out of context, and he'd tell me the context. So sometimes he hadn't even said it at all. You know, he'd said something with a very vague resemblance to what I was being told Banty said, blah, blah, blah. But I was fortunate in being able to do that, but of course not everybody did have that.
Yeah. I think what we should do is have a tea break.
Yeah.
And then come back and have questions, because people will, you know, people can have tea break, think about questions. But I want to say thank you for being here straight from Mexico and talking, but also just for being there then, you know, because I think we're all lucky that there were you and a few others who were there being, you know.
But let me just say, it was also extraordinarily exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was like when I got involved in the movement, I just could not believe my luck. In a way, I'd been looking for something. I'd been looking politically. I'd been looking in all sorts of ways for something to change the world. That's what interested me. I wasn't particularly interested in personal development. That was a bit of a byproduct for me. I really wasn't. That wasn't what I was looking for at all. I wanted to change the world. And when I stumbled in on Buddhism and I heard this lecture by Sangha Rakshita about changing the world, I was like, where do I sign up? And also Buddhism just spoke to me very immediately. And we were all young and we were all a bit stupid and there was a lot of fire and a lot of, you know, it was a great sort of time in the movement as well. And there was a lot of stupid things happening and a lot of exciting things happening. And sometimes it's hard to know which was which, you know.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.